Hi there, my name is Ishmael Ozan, and many of you know me as the Dane County District Attorney, but I am also a husband and a father of two young girls. Today I am asking you to make the choice my wife and I made, to not use physical punishment with our children. Many of us are not aware that over 16 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics urged doctors to recommend that parents not use physical punishment on their children. Today, over 100 years of research on children and families supports this recommendation. Look, well-meaning parents may use physical discipline intending to teach their children to make good choices, but we now know that physical discipline actually leads to more disobedience and aggressive behaviors in children. We all want what is best for our kids. Today, we now know what is best for kids is parenting based on respect, mutual understanding, and logic, rather than fear of physical pain. Please join me in learning more about positive parenting and creating a violence-free home.
Paid for by the Dane County District Attorney's Office with support from UW Health American Family Children's Hospital.
Welcome to another podcast at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining me now from the Capital Times and the Nation, it's John Nichols. John, right when you think Donald Trump really can't go any lower or break any further norm, he does. Here he is with Chris Wallace the other day.
37 years, former head of U.S. Special Operations.
Hillary Clinton fan.
Special Operations.
Excuse me, Hillary Clinton fan.
Who led the operations, commanded the operations that took down Saddam Hussein and that killed Osama bin Laden, says that your sentiment is the greatest threat to democracy in his lifetime.
He's a Hillary Clinton backer and an Obama backer. And frankly,
he was a Navy SEAL.
Wouldn't it have been nice if we got Osama bin Laden a lot sooner than that?
This is after a week where he missed a major event in France commemorating the 100th anniversary of the ending of World War I. He didn't go to Arlington National Cemetery for Veterans Day again. He's got troops at the border doing absolutely nothing. You know, I don't really think he could even try any harder to anger people that serve in the military.
No, it's an interesting thing with Trump. And, you know, you would have thought that, though, back when he, like, kind of attacked John McCain, you know, more than two years ago. So there's clearly a portion of folks. And it's an interesting question, sorry, of whether it's the bubble, right, that some of these folks only are getting, you know, kind of a pretty positive image of Trump, pretty positive message from him from certain media. And as a result, aren't aware of his really very dismissive attitude toward veterans, toward courageous service, toward the basic duties of a president as regards historic moments like the anniversary of the armistice. But because he did that in that setting, right, one would presume a lot of folks who might have otherwise been in the bubble, they couldn't exactly miss that one, could they?
Well, his numbers among people, the surveys that have done among people that are in the military is slipping.
Yeah.
It's just, I can't even conjure up what the hell he was thinking by saying that stuff.
I know, it's so, well, but it goes to the heart of the matter, right? That, you know, as a guy who somehow found it possible to not serve in the military at key times, his age being such that he might well have served. But as a guy who didn't serve, he has, don't you think, almost a desperation to come off as a tough guy, right? Or like he's so frequently dismissive of people who served courageously and or strategically, very, you know, like really brought a lot of, you know, skill to the to it. And in each case, you know, whether it's dismissing McCain or now dismissing, you know, this current topic of his criticism, you know, it's like he always seems to have something to criticize about, you know, either you got, you know, captured as prisoner of war. There's something wrong with that, or you didn't get bin Laden quickly enough, right, or something
right.
Like that. And it's like, in every case, it's Trump having this hard guy attitude, but you know, at a certain point, I think that people who serve in the military recognize that that's A, unrealistic, right? Because some people will be captured, not because they failed in any way, but because they courageously went into the most difficult of circumstances. And some tasks will be difficult, not because people don't put sufficient effort into it, but because it's just hard to get things right.
Well, speaking of getting things right, he couldn't even get the name of a city that he was visiting that was incinerated in California right. And, of course, if you see the footage of California Governor Jerry Brown and California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, governor-elect, they look like they're in some sort of a hostage video with him. But
they look like they're in pain.
They're in horrible pain. Here's Donald Trump.
I'm committed to make sure that we get all of this cleaned out and protected. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have a much different, we're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spent a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. You don't see what's going on until you come here. And what we saw at Pleasure, what a name right now. But when what we just saw, we just left Pleasure.
Paradise.
And what we just saw at Paradise is just, you know, it's just not acceptable.
Is Pleasure some porn movie that he was watching? Is that?
Yeah, I know.
Where did that come from?
It's obvious in a lot of these settings that he goes into circumstances where pretty much every previous president, I don't care if it's Barack Obama or George W. Bush or Gerald Ford or, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, you know, whoever goes, historically presidents try to be very prepared before they step into a setting, right? They want to do well, not to make mistakes. It doesn't mean presidents don't make mistakes. They do. But they want to try and avoid mistakes for two reasons. Number one, they know they're always the center of attention. They don't want to draw attention away from what they're doing by making errors that become the subject of a new discussion. And two, they're very conscious of the fact that they are, in fact, representing not just themselves, but the United States of America. And I think it's that second thing that is very key as regards Trump. I think that Trump, you know, his sort of default position is that he's representing Trump, right? That he, I'm here as me. It happens I'm president, but I'm me. And as such, I don't think he puts that sort of extra step into preparation that every previous president has.
You know, there's another explanation. He doesn't really care.
Well, same thing. I don't know if he doesn't care. I mean, I at some fundamental level, he may care. He may be concerned. I'm willing to give him that. But it's a question of caring enough, right, and feeling a sense of duty to get it right. And, you know, where that lack of concern comes in, right, where it prevents him from doing it, is a really good question. And, you know, Si, people are going to wrestle with this for the rest of time because, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's going to be this period in our history where we had a president who was manifestly ill-prepared for the office. He didn't know what he was getting into or what he was doing. Doesn't make him stupid, but he just was ill-prepared. He didn't know. And who wasn't interested in getting up to speed, right? Who didn't grow in office. And that's a really big deal, Si, because you've been around politics for a long time, right? You've watched it.
I have. And I've watched presidents after midterm disasters make course corrections.
And grow in office.
Right.
Get better at it.
I think we all saw Bill Clinton go to Oklahoma City and, you know, give the speech of his life.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And then another example, to give you an example, look, there's simply no question that Barack Obama, I mean, he came in as a brilliant orator, and as somebody who had legislative experience, he had not been an executive. And I think it's clear that over time, you know, he got better and better and better at it. I mean, don't you think, and I'm not advocating for this one way or the other, don't you think that if Obama had a third term, you know, I mean, I just thought he was finishing out his second term really on top of things. And so people grow in office. They get better and better at it. But I see no evidence of that with Trump.
Here is... Here's how not to go out when you lose. This is...
Governor Walker pointed out that 30,000 more people voted for him this time than last time. And then he said this.
But the numbers we received a week ago Tuesday would have won the election 4 years ago. They would have won the election 8 years ago. So no way do I see it as a rejection, but rather just a larger electorate than we've ever seen in the past.
So let's review the bidding. You got more votes than you did the last time. Well, the other guy got more votes than you did this time. You lost. Well, yes, that's how it works. It's kind of like an NFL coach saying, hey, sure, we scored fewer points than the other guy, so technically we lost, but the points we scored would have won last week and the week before. So how do you see it as a loss? Look, some candidates blame money. The other guy had too much. Some blame the media, biased against me, and some claim voter fraud even when they win, Donald Trump. Maybe we should all just take a page from the late, great Arizona Congressman Mo Udall. He ran a long shot campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination in 76, and after finishing second to Jimmy Carter in way too many primaries, Udall quipped, "The people have spoken, the bastards." We'll be right back.
I didn't know Mo Udall said that. The bastards.
Yeah. He also, Mo Udall had one other great line, and then we really need to circle back to Walker. But Mo Udall had another great line. He was campaigning in New Hampshire and stopping into businesses in some small town, you know, walking into the coffee shop and stuff, and he comes into a barber shop and he says, "Hey, I'm Mo Udall," and he shakes hands with the barber and guy in the chair. And the barber says, "Yeah, I know. We were just laughing about it a couple minutes ago." The more you don't run for president. He says, "Yeah, we were just laughing about that a couple minutes ago." And, you know, the genius of Udall as a candidate was he was so self-deprecating, so good at making fun of himself that, you know, it's always a pleasure to be with him. Everyone loved him. But there is some suggestion that he might actually have been so self-deprecating that people started to buy into it.
Right.
And that's always a problem. Now, with Scott Walker, self-deprecation is not an issue, I don't think. I mean, that was a remarkable... I mean, almost everything about Scott Walker's reaction to his defeat has been remarkable, right? The notion that, you know, he got more votes than he had, you know, in the past. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, do you know who else gets more votes than they got in the past? Fred Risser.
There's more people voting.
Right. It was Fred Risser who came into state politics in the mid-1950s. You know, there were fewer people then. So, yeah, he gets more votes. But, you know, the interesting thing about the difference between Fred Risser and Scott Walker is Fred Risser wins and Scott Walker lost. I think the biggest evidence of Walker's wrestling with this is that a guy who, in my opinion, is very, very good at politics usually. Scott Walker, I think, is very skilled as a political figure and knows how to strategize, get on top of things, get ahead of things. You know, he is blowing his transition, I think, very badly. Not just being, you know, setting himself up for ridicule on national media with his statements, but also this talk about trying to take away, you know, the sympathy with Robin Voss's proposal for taking away powers or for altering the date of the state Supreme Court election in 2020, you know, gaming the system against his successor.
Yeah, we've got here, let me play that clip. I've got a clip of him actually talking about that.
Ford's always seemed odd to me. I didn't have a bill before me on that any time in the past, but it is something that anybody who's been a local government, not just me, but any municipal or county official, I think often has found that those issues are very different than what you have when you have a presidential preference primary.
I didn't know issues had to coincide to share an election.
Well, here's the interesting thing about that spot. You may not remember, this is ancient history, so you claw your way back to this, see if you can recall it. 2016?
Whew, that's a long time ago, John.
I know it is, but if you think back all the way to then, it'd be an interesting little subtlety here. You had Democratic and Republican presidential primaries, and they were on the same day as a Supreme Court election when Scott Walker's appointee to the court was up for election. And it was a contentious Supreme Court election playing out parallel to presidential elections. And do you recall Scott Walker talking about his problem with that or his concerns about that?
I don't remember that at all, as a matter of fact. You know, it's interesting. Yeah. County clerks all over the state now are saying, we would rather have one election than two.
But you realize, yeah, in addition to talking here, what they're talking about is millions of dollars being spent, you know, to avoid a high turnout election for the Supreme Court, right? That's what we're really talking about. But imagine, the scenario that Scott Walker's talking about. To avoid having his appointee to the Supreme Court face a high turnout election, i.e., parallel to a presidential primary, which is, by the way, what we had in 2016, but also pretty much, you know, there have been a couple variations, but pretty much again and again throughout the past, going back, you know, to the 60s,
well,
right?
And let us remember, if Democrats hadn't been stupid and moved their primary day in 2008,
Louis Butler would have been the
Supreme Court Justice.
Without a doubt. But, you know, it's interesting that the Diane Sykes Louis Butler race, which was back, I think, in 2000, was parallel to a primary.
Right.
It happened to be, you know, not as contentious. Ronald Reagan won a primary in Wisconsin parallel to a contentious Supreme Court race. This happened again and again and again. So this is a part of our history. They're proposing to change this at huge expense to the taxpayers to protect a very weak justice who's
never faced the voters.
That's right. And so they're clearly gaming the system out. What that would create, by the way, in 2020, is a situation where Wisconsin voters would vote in a February primary, this rescheduled probably March presidential primary, an April Supreme Court general election, an August primary, and a November general election. You know, so
ridiculous.
All right, we
got to take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us at sliceoffice.com.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson is a multifaceted guitar shop offering guitar instruction, new and used guitars and amplifiers, and all accessories. Instead of experiencing the total hassle of a big box store or a snarky boutique, take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson and experience what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We love guitars.
We're back at sliceoffice.com. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Stacey Abrams' non-concession speech was one of the most remarkable things that I think I've heard in all the years I've been following politics. Maybe in my lifetime, this was almost like a Rosa Parks moment. Let me play the clip.
This is not a speech of concession. Because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that. But my assessment is the law currently allows no further viable remedy. Now, I could certainly bring a new case to keep this one contest alive, but I don't want to hold public office if I need to scheme my way into the post. Because the title of governor isn't nearly as important as our shared title, voters. And that is why we fight on.
All right. And she also said this.
Pundits and hyperpartisans will hear my words as a rejection of the normal order. You see, I'm supposed to say nice things and accept my fate. They will complain that I should not use this moment to recap what was done wrong or to demand a remedy. You see, as a leader, I should be stoic in my outrage and silent in my rebuke. But stoicism is a luxury, and silence is a weapon for those who would quiet the voices of the people. And I will not concede because the erosion of our democracy is not right.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And guess what?
Yeah.
What she predicted, the punditry class in this country did exactly what she said they'd do.
Yeah, no, look, she's a very remarkable woman who I think a lot of Americans started to get to know just at the end of that campaign. If they knew more about her, they would be even more impressed. She is she's a very successful fiction writer. She could not be in politics at all and be a prominent figure. She writes books on the side. She was leader in the legislature in her state. She really mounted a campaign that sort of brought a revolutionary vision to how you organize a campaign in a state that is thought to be politically difficult, even insurmountable for a Democratic candidate, you know, reaching way beyond traditional boundaries and focusing on issues as well as mobilization. There's little doubt that her candidacy, much like Beto O'Rourke's in Texas, while unsuccessful on election day, or at least, you know, didn't prevail, helped to elect all kinds of people down ballot. Remarkably enough, there's a decent chance that Georgia will elect a new Secretary of State, and it's possible even the Democrat could win it because there's a runoff for it, because of the votes, you know, because of the people she mobilized and got to the polls. So she had a profound impact. And it's fascinating to me how negative some of the reaction to her has been.
Well, let me play. This is Sherrod Brown on with Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this past Sunday.
Let me start with you were out this week talking about another race in 2018, and it was in Georgia, and Stacey Abrams. It was before she had acknowledged her defeat. She has now admitted defeat, didn't call it a concession. But I want to ask you about something you said this week about Georgia. Let me play it.
If Stacey Abrams doesn't win in Georgia, they stole it. It's clear. It's clear. And I would say, I say that publicly. It's clear.
Strong language. To throw that out there, you believe today that this is a stolen race, and basically Brian Kemp is somebody who's illegally governor, right, or governor-elect of Georgia.
Well, I think you'll look at the lead-up to this election, the Secretary of State, and I was a Secretary of State in Ohio 30 years ago. I know what you do as Secretary of State. You encourage people to vote. You don't purge millions of voters. You don't close down polling places in rural areas where voters have difficulty getting to the polls, which were mostly low-income areas. You don't do what Republicans are doing all over the country. And you've seen it, Chuck. You've seen the kind of voter suppression that all over this country. And you end with the Secretary of State of Georgia should have recused himself from running that election, as Jimmy, because former Georgia resident, former President Jimmy Carter said he should. And clearly, he did everything he could to put his thumb on the scale and won that election, quote-unquote, won that election by only about a point.
I guess I would ask this. Couldn't you bring up all of those issues, lay all of that out without using the word stolen? And I throw that out there because we have enough distrust in our institutions as it is.
Don't do the false equivalency of the you know, lack of respect in institutions. I mean, we have a president that attacks your profession day after day after day. If you saw the earlier part of my election night speech, you would have heard me thank the media, and you would have seen hundreds of people in Ohio on the Democratic at this election night gathering turn around and clap for the media. We see a president that goes after the courts, that goes after the judicial system, a president that says, as the votes were counted, that something's been wrong with the elections. He criticizes the elections that way. So don't play this false equivalency because a former Secretary of State like me said that about this election, which clearly is an effort to suppress the vote, not of people that look like you and me, Chuck,
right,
but people of color especially. And it's happened. I'll spend your airtime. I don't mean to lecture.
No, spend your airtime
critical of those people who are trying to suppress the vote.
And we spend a lot of time criticizing that, too. I'm just asking you about choice of words and language. But
sure.
I don't remember him spending a lot of time criticizing it. I heard him covering it. But what's wrong with saying stolen? How else would you put it?
Well, and I mean, look, the key to that, and Sherrod Brown mentioned it but didn't belabor the fact, is that he was a Secretary of State, right? He actually knows his way around this stuff really well. It happens just through dumb luck. I covered him. Going way back, I've known Sherrod Brown since, if you can imagine it, the 1980s. And I saw him deal with all kinds of election issues and some really ugly campaigns.
Well, and we saw a couple of his successors in Ohio do some of the same things Brian Kemp did.
Yeah, and notably Sherrod Brown wasn't accused of playing games like that. He
right.
was a good Secretary of State, and he really, I think he loved the job. And so he's speaking as somebody with a lot of experience and speaking very, very bluntly about a concern of his and using words, I mean, obviously using words carefully that he had thought through. And here's the really important thing that he did. When Chuck Todd raised a legitimate question, it's fine. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have done it the same way, but, you know, Chuck Todd puts his question out. Sherrod Brown goes back at him. And this is when people are starting to think about, and I say this very bluntly, people are starting to think about 2020 presidential candidates, right? Potential presidential candidates. Look at what Sherrod Brown did there. He refused to back off, get kind of like put in a corner, or get, you know, join in the vapid discussion of these things. He said, no, I said what I meant, and here's why, and don't do this false equivalent.
Oh, it was a very important moment for him, because some people think he's too nice to be president, maybe a little too laid back, but that was a pretty important moment. But, you know, it isn't just Chuck Todd. Somebody, I think it was from the Washington Post, wrote a big piece saying, don't use the word stolen. And here's Michael Shear, the Washington correspondent for the New York Times, on CNN's Inside Politics.
There are three big national icons in this campaign year, if you will. Beto O'Rourke, Stacey Abrams, and Andrew Gillum. Lost.
They all lost.
But they've established themselves as rising stars in the party. The question is, what next? But in the case of Georgia, you've had the president being suddenly really nice to them, which is part of an interesting wrinkle to Stacey Abrams and to Andrew Gillum. But listen, in Georgia, the Democrats, the president said there was fraud in Florida. The president says people get in their cars and change and the like. Democrats are saying this election in Georgia was stolen.
I know Stacey well. She was one of my really strong surrogates in the campaign. If she'd had a fair election, she already would have won.
If Stacey Abrams doesn't win in Georgia, they stole it. It's clear. It's clear.
I think that Stacey Abrams' election is being stolen from her using what I think are insidious measures to disenfranchise certain groups of people.
Now, their argument is voting rights, suppression of votes, intimidation. But it is it's a difficult balance after an election. As you know, the new governor's going to take office. He's a Republican. How do you handle this?
Well, and look, part of it goes back to this bifurcation that Sahil was talking about. The country is being sort of sorted into, you know, much redder places, much bluer places. I grew up in Southern California. I went to college in Southern California. I spent a lot of time in Richmond, Virginia, two suburbs that are completely changing. And so the benefit for Democrats is in places in the House and in some places that, like Virginia, that may turn more blue in a presidential race, but it means that the other parts of the country are getting redder, and that's where a candidate like Stacey Abrams has more trouble as a result. And the Democrats, you know, can try the tactic of blaming voter suppression and some of these issues, and no doubt some of that stuff is going on, but it's just much more difficult when they are running in these kinds of red places to kind of change the dynamic.
I do think we will.
That's a reporter. Ooh, well, Georgia's a red place. He totally skimmed over the fact what had happened during that election.
Well, yeah, first off, this isn't being said just after the election. It's not sore loser stuff, right? People are talking about this months out, long, saying, look, there are problems here. There are bad things happening. I wrote about it. But worse than that is he actually, you know, sort of admits to it. He goes, well, yeah, maybe some of that's happening, right?
Yeah.
So you're acknowledging there's voter suppression in a race lie that is decided by a handful of votes, you know, by a very narrow margin, right? The question whether Stacey Abrams would have gotten into a runoff, right, which is really the small number of votes that were at stake. And so the suppression becomes hugely significant.
So can you explain that? I mean, look, I don't dislike Chuck Todd or Michael Scheer, you know, but what's this reaction all about?
I think this is one of the complexities of how our politics is covered in America, and that is that we have elite media in the United States, at broadcast and some newspapers nationally, which want to claim that they are the you know, constantly the even-handed arbiter, right? The people that look from above at all of this and, you know, are fair to both parties and, you know, it's fair and balanced. And all this. And what they don't realize, and this is an important thing, what they don't realize is that when you bring a false equivalency to this, when you suggest, well, you know, boy, maybe you shouldn't be so blunt in that language, or, you know, maybe some of this happens, but it's also, you know, all these other blah, 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 you aren't being fair. And you aren't being balanced. What you are being is, you know, you're tipping the balance, right? You are giving an advantage to those who should be criticized, right? And so I think it's a very damaging way to talk about politics. It is not a useful way to discuss politics. The way you ought to do it is to, yes, do try to be fair, right? Do try to, you know, hear both sides and, you know, try to make sure that reasonable voices are heard and disagreement and debate. Yes, all of that is good. But when it is clear that deeply problematic things are happening, right, that's the point at which you're supposed to step up and say, yes, something bad is happening here. There is a big problem with this election.
As we wrap things up, let me ask you two things here. First of all, in all the years you've been involved in around politics, have you ever heard a bunch of lefties saying, God, how can we find a way to stop people in Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee County from voting? How can we keep them away from the polls? Have you ever heard that? Because I have never complained that people vote in high numbers that happen to disagree with me. I complain about a lot of things. I've never complained about that, and I've never heard anyone conspiring to disenfranchise those voters. Second part of the question is, since Reconstruction, you know, in the South, and there's also been efforts, obviously, in the North as well, to disenfranchise African-American and other minority voters, is it that it's been such the norm for so long that the media almost just accepts it as a premise, as a fact of life?
I think there has been a failure. I think there was a deep, deep failure in our media from the 60s on to cover the ongoing dynamics of Jim Crow, right? And it's play out in the post-civil rights, post-voting rights era. And I think that only now, in some ways, obviously, I wrote a book about the Florida fight, so I think there was things that were dredged up there that were incredibly significant. But I think only now are we beginning to get a broader discussion of these problems. And so the media perhaps has a role, say that. But I will also say the core thing that you're going at there is, you know, this question of the attitudes of different sides of the political divide as regards high turnout elections. And we should talk more about high turnout elections. It's an interesting dynamic here. You ask yourself, well, why doesn't, you know, Scott Walker, for instance, want to have the Supreme Court election in 2020 held at a point where you can have a particularly high turnout, right? Well, because he's afraid that turnout won't be favorable to his candidate. And here you have a situation of politicians picking the election that they
right.
want, you know? Like, they want to game the system so that it's beneficial to them. And in some ways, you understand why. Because, Sly, on November 6th, the United States had the highest midterm turnout, apparently, since 1914. And as all the results come in and things get counted, what we find is that you had a pretty remarkable election for the Democrats. Seven governors picked up. They won two-thirds of the Senate seats. They took the House of Representatives, apparently, with the largest pickup since the Watergate era.
We getting close to 40 yeah. seats here?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that high turnout elections appear in many circumstances to be beneficial to the Democrats. Your Republican friends have two choices in this circumstance. A, they could adjust their message so that they appeal to a lot of people, as exactly what Dwight Eisenhower did in the 50s. They had very high turnout elections. He actually reached out to, you know, the whole of America and was highly successful as a moderate Republican. Or they can stay, you know, firmly where they're at politically, firmly in the pocket of big business, hard to the right on a host of issues, and hope, as you know, obviously some of the folks in Wisconsin are, that they can figure out a way to game the process, move the election day or do something else that will make it possible for them to win. And of course, this takes us to that deeper question, which we don't have time for, but we can sum it up in one word, and that is gerrymandering.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation, thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.